Good day and welcome to the Daily Friend, your source of news and information. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, once again standing in for Big Daddy Liberty, who is unfortunately off sick at the moment, but he should be back with us at the end of the week. And so we're going to jump right into it. I'm joined with my co-hosts here, Herman Pretorius, a man you know well from this podcast. Herman, how are you today?
Fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. And Mr. Terence Corrigan, our project manager at the Institute of Race Relations. How are you this morning?
I'm good, Nicholas. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. All right, so for our first topic, Terence, why don't you tell us about the new EE report and what it says or what it's proposing?
Well, you know, I think that that those with the fortitude can go and wade through the 100-odd pages themselves. It's entitled Transformation Does Make Business Sense. And it amounts to...
Does it define what transformation is?
Well, I think that's something you sort of have to read between the lines. What they say, though, is that, that there's been a lot of focus on the supposed failings of particularly the private sector to achieve demographic representativity in the top management levels. And a great deal of attention has been given to the fact that so about two-thirds of top management positions are held by white people, with black Africans accounting for 15.1%. More important, I think, than the content of the report has been what the minister has said at the release of the report, that self-regulation is not working.
That's a bit ominous.
Yes, and his words were, the lack of transformation in employment must be tackled head-on, and employment equity must be tackled head-on through a number of strategies. Talking about increasing the risk of non-compliance. There is talk of promulgating an amendment to the Act, Section 53, which requires that in order to do business with the state, you will have to show an employment equity compliance certificate. Those who do not comply, says Minister Nesi, must face the music or be punished. What is interesting for me about the report, though, is that it presents table after table and infographic after infographic, but nowhere that nowhere can I see what the drivers are of this of the supposed failure. There seems to be very little interest in explaining it or understanding it, merely sort of presenting presenting the state of play as something.
From your description here, it sounds a little bit like they're kind of implying that it's just a lack of will as to why it's not been implemented so far.
Well, I think one can reasonably infer that, and I think that's most of the problem. That there are inferences made about these sort of things, which tells me that we're not really serious about dealing with any problems as they exist, but rather with a sort of ideological dimension. There's also a very interesting. And I think revealing comment in the concluding observations. Let me read a few. The high representation of the foreign national population group. I love the word population group. It does sort of have a have a ring to it that harks back to sort of pre-1989, but let's leave that aside. Yeah. Particularly at the lower occupation levels remains a serious concern. Questions need to be asked whether our labor laws governing migration are adequately implemented in South Africa, especially in a country with a current unemployment rate in excess of 27%. I think they're being rather generous there. The justification for them, I presume being that foreign national population group, occupying positions that require very little or no skill at all, need to be assessed given the high rate of unemployed South African locals seeking work. It's interesting, isn't it? There's certain level, I don't know, Herman, would you agree with me?
It's interesting, isn't the word I'd use, ominous, or you can say communist. I mean, it's really quite terrifying, the ideological ramping up and acceleration we've seen over the last few weeks, and not just, from in the past we've heard similar noises, but those were from either low-ranking government members or, party chairmen or provincial officials. Now this is coming out of cabinet. This is now government policy. And then we had Premier Makura in Gauteng yesterday speaking about, the cracking down on foreign employment and how certain businesses should only be the province province of South African citizens, and this all forms part of a rather upsetting trend of an ever-increasing, overbearing state that's really, you know, it's accelerating. It's terrifying, actually.
So, and a certain level of xenophobia, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, and racism. It's blatant.
So, Herman, if there's one thing we can say about the ANC government, it's that its commitment to employment equity policy has been one of the core pillars of things that that government has pursued most aggressively, most consistently, everywhere from the sort of local to the provincial level. With that in mind, and it often seems like the government is really trying to fix our problems with the square peg, the round hole of our problems with the square peg of employment equity.
Mm.
With that in mind, why do you think they're doubling down on this? Why are we seeing yet another proposal to triple down on employment equity policy?
Genuinely, it's a question of playing the political game, or they genuinely think this is going to help. If we do them the favor of, you know, granting their bona fides that they genuinely think this is a problem and this will help, then they are doubling down in a sense, because it's clear to everyone in this country we're heading for a big crisis in the foreseeable future in terms of employment, in terms of the economy, in terms of state expenditure, in terms of a tax base that is emigrating faster than you can say national democratic revolution. So that's the one element. They could genuinely be trying to fix the problems that we are facing. Or this could just be a desperate attempt to cling to power, to play the populist game, to throw absolutely the baby out with the bathwater and think, well, it's panic time. We as the ANC, or we as the dominant faction in cabinet, the leftist, the communist, it's now time for us to take control of the discussion. We've been weak so far. Now is the time to show our strength.
So, Terence, what do you believe is the driving force behind this?
I don't discount what Herman says, but I think maybe you could reduce it to a simpler formulation. I don't think that there's any kind of imagination. I think that this is simply the script, and there's an inability to think outside the ideological precepts. The ANC. Part of its makeup is fundamentally nationalist. It views itself as embodying the people, as you may, you know, however you may define the people, but that frequently is not all the people of South Africa. You know, the phrase "our people," for instance. And you know, I think within that framework, this has a very, very powerful resonance. It's a kind of designated benefit. If the economy was simply growing and we were all becoming more prosperous, and you know, more and more opportunities were presenting themselves, and more black people were taking advantage and you know, there were entrepreneurial opportunities, etc., that would be better for the whole country, and it'd be better for the nominal beneficiaries. But it's not something that the government would be able to claim credit for.
Yeah,
it's not a kind of designated benefit, and I think this is why something like this is such a holy cow.
So this is paying off a faction of the population, essentially.
Paying off a faction of the population, but also acting. But I don't even think that that's dominant. I think it's acting true to ideological type.
Mm-hmm.
The polling data on public appetite for these sort of policies, attitudes towards preferential policies in South Africa, by no means suggests that it's
wildly
popular.
There's a great yearning out there for it. No.
People want a prosperous society. They want opportunities. The idea that somehow, you know, you want to see things, see yourself, quote unquote, represented by someone else, I don't think that has a major resonance with most people, but it does with our political class.
Yeah.
Because it's something you can measure. It's something that you can you can reduce complex dynamics almost to
racial representation.
Just sort of child's building blocks.
Yeah.
And also, when the problem is white monopoly capital is the source of all evil, then
yes,
anything that attacks or is seen to attack white monopoly capital seems to be the way to go.
One thing that upsets me about this aggression on this point of, you know, job reservation, as it were, is it gives an out to the government on bad education policy. Were it not for this kind of prescription of who can get a job or not, people who go to public schools and are dependent on the public education system would not be able to compete in the jobs market. This is a kind of a convenient way to say, well, we know, well, I don't know if there are, if this implication has been thought through, but it certainly is a convenient way to legislate people into jobs who do not qualify for jobs because the government failed them in the first place. So, I mean, this is a, it's this worrying idea of trying to put a finger into every crack in the dam wall, so that you can control the dam. And, I mean, history shows that that's not possible. Every time you stop one crack, the pressure goes to another. So, but we at the IRR and the CRA, France has France Grenier, our director and CEO, has he said that these people would speak to him about policy. He would give them a briefing on policy and what will happen, what has happened, what could happen. And then their response is, oh, yeah, that's fascinating. The data surely so shows this. But what about our ideology? So it comes back to Terence's point. This is the script they're reading from. It's I don't know what else to say.
Look, it's disturbing. You know, look, as I say, what is concerning to me is the apparent lack of trying to understand the drivers here. You just assume that there's some sort of malevolent hatred for or exclusion of people based on based on skin color. Without a credible education system, you shut millions and millions of people out. I mean, you know, one doesn't even have to go to senior positions in a mining company. There's been some interesting research done on the informal traders in South Africa, and you'll find that people from Congo or from Zimbabwe can often outcompete South Africans in South Africa because of basic things like numeracy. One can say what one's about Robert Mugabe, but he certainly presided over a culture that took its education very seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he was forever getting degrees and whatever, and
his wife as well.
His wife was
slightly Dr. Grace.
A slightly different case, you see, the thing is that was something that Zimbabwe got right.
Yes.
You have people coming to South Africa, and I think this is maybe also germane to this comment here about this concern about all these foreigners coming and taking our jobs. Now,
yes.
You know, when one says that with a redneck accent, it suddenly takes on a different. But I think it's really that.
Do you think the minister might be interested in perhaps building a wall?
With a big, beautiful gate that aims at mostly...
I don't know, would that make the labor market great again? But you know what
Bigly.
And not Donald Trump.
Okay, but you know what I'm saying here is that a lot of these positions which, you know, don't require any skill, that's not entirely true. You know, an unskilled position, you know, maybe does assume a certain level of literacy or numeracy, certain ability to think to think independently, and that may well be what gives an quote unquote unskilled Zimbabwean edge over his or her South African counterpart.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Also, those sort of things that you also pick up in school that are not necessarily measured, like discipline, showing up boys at the same time, that kind of thing. And if you're school system is so broken that you're sitting in a class where your SAT2 teacher only shows up for 3 hours a week, your perception of what it means to have sort of personal self-discipline might be somewhat hurt.
I think it was the State of the Nation speech earlier this year. President Ramaphosa was talking about making sure every kid at the age of 10 could read for meaning. That, you know, when a society at this level of development, I mean, gets that right. If he gets that right, God bless him. Mm. And I'll personally, you know,
it'll be brilliant.
But you know, why are we at that level of abject catastrophe where being able to read is an aspiration?
Yeah.
You know, the other thing is it's not just about education. I think also about the fractured nature of our society. the collapse of the collapse of things like socializing institutions like your family.
Yes,
very interesting. I think difference between South Africa and many of our peer countries in this continent, despite our level of development and relative prosperity. And I think, and this is one area where I do think that one has to point fingers at apartheid very, very strong, segregation very strongly, particularly in the migrant worker system and whatever.
Yes.
The destruction of the African family unit was an absolute crime.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we can stress strongly enough just how damaging it was. A society like Nigeria, which is chaotic, does
have that. Very dysfunctional, yes.
But it has social bonds that, you know, make that give people a place in society and provide them with safety nets and whatever. In fact, I remember speaking to a Nigerian living in South Africa. He says that he refuses to allow his daughter to sort of be outside their yard here. And his village near Lagos, you know, just be back for supper. And he kind of knows that community will keep an eye out for children.
I think on the other point is, of course, it is definitely at least partially a legacy of the past, our sort of systems of segregation, migrant labor, and all that kind of thing. But our current government has also been very ineffective in fixing that problem after a quarter of a century of policy.
Well, I think I agree with you. Although in mitigation, what exactly does a state do? I think Lawrence Schneemer put that well. States are just not well equipped to deal with those sort of social problems. I think where we can point a finger is to say that the solutions that have been proposed, you know, your youth commissions or whatever. Maybe would have some purpose of our or have some traction if our resources were limitless and our problems weren't this great.
Yes.
But all right. Yeah.
Before we get too sucked into trying to fix all the country's problems in one discussion, let's move on to our everyone's favorite president, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, who was recently in France at a G7 conference. Herman, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. This goes back to the discussion we had, I think, earlier this week about, or end of last week, can't remember, about the President's Q&A session in Parliament. And punted the investment drive to attract investors to South Africa. And in November, he has another investment conference or summit or get-together or whatever. And his going to the G7, being invited by President Macron of France, he wanted to go there and push South Africa as, you know, the trade or the investment destination in Africa. And he wanted to push the free trade, the continent-wide free trade agreement, which I think is a good thing. And he wanted to say, you know, Africa is the frontier of trade, and that's where the attention should be. And that's all good and well. But you can't convince someone to give you their investment if you are telling your own people that you're going to take that investment and pump it into absolute loss-making ideas
like
Eskom and the NHI. So on the one hand, I can't remember where I read it. I think it might have been R.W. Johnson who wrote that Ramaphosa is trying to talk up the economy rather than fix it.
Yes.
You can't actually say...
As though confidence is based on nothing but positive feelings.
Yes, and that's the whole philosophy behind his, you know, his investment team and his investment ambassadors and gurus and Trevor Manuel. The problem is, at some point, the tire needs to hit the road that investment isn't just about, you know, liking the face behind the presidential podium.
I think some of this is as a result of what the ANC has always played this game where it's been sort of on the international stage, kind of these more liberal face, and it's always talked up investment. And it's
like Mandela at Davos.
Exactly. But... at home, it's still been the sort of racial nationalist, kind of socialistic-y oriented organization. And Ramaphosa is trying to take that to its sort of logical extreme by implementing some of the most racial nationalist and most socialist policies we've seen out of the ANC government.
While sounding as capitalist and free market as possible. Yeah. And the problem is, he told Mr. Maimane in Parliament, you know, follow me to the investment summit and listen to what the investors are saying about ANC economic policy. And we don't have to wait until November. We can look at the equity and bond outflow, the capital flight that's happening now.
This is another
follow
problem.
The money.
Is what people say in this realm of investment seems to be very disconcordant with what they actually do. Regardless of what investors or business leaders may say, there is a lot of money leaving the country right now.
And if to bring it back to the G7, the Eurozone isn't in a brilliant situation. No country is really in a brilliant situation economically. I think the United States might be best positioned at this point. But if you're going to get $99 back on your $100 investment, you're going to go for that rather than getting nothing back by losing that $100 into a place like Eskom. The government is fundamentally untethering everything that makes investment sensible. Expropriation of property without compensation. The bill doesn't say, just land is property. It means any property. Pension funds, that's just the logical conclusion of what you worked for, what's yours, the state can use to fund
medical
the state.
Aids.
And medical aids. And so, I mean, and good grief.
Yeah, no, it's a bit of a dog and pony show.
Yes.
I remember going back to I think he was still deputy president at the time, Becky, talking about a report, the business confidence index, and it showed that business confidence was down. His response was, "Well, that certainly isn't the experience of black business people." Now here's the point. The business confidence index was not some sort of opinion survey about how you thought it was. Are you putting your money in? Now, I can't believe that Mbeki didn't know this. So, when spin is displaced reality.
Yes.
When you start believing your own spin.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if either of you watched that that delightful show MythBusters.
Yes.
In the opening credits, I reject your reality and substitute my own. I think that as with employment equity, there is a sort of dogged commitment to a particular script and a particular narrative within which everything else must fit. South Africa. So the senior politicians in South Africa have been calling. Have been referring to South Africa as a developmental state, for well over a decade. It's laughable.
Yeah, we've now lost the develop. It's now just a mental state.
Well, there you go.
Thank you very much. But it's ironic, in the midst of this script, here comes Tito Mboweni with something that I've glanced at it. I haven't read it in depth yet. I think later in the week we might actually look at it properly. But here comes Tito Mboweni with the most capitalist sounding plans that have come out of the ANC since the early 2000s, and that's how it's not going to work. Because he's not on script. He's going to get stymied. He was also during his first budget speech. He spoke about some austerity measures in the public sector being cut in terms of their numbers. That got stymied. Unbundling Eskom, stymied. Any good idea that we know? It's not a secret. No one is mystified by what causes economic growth. It's not a problem that needs to be solved. It's a problem that was solved within the last 200 years quite conclusively. And you can work on the effect of economic growth and how to ensure that it is a kind of an inclusive economic growth, absolutely. But what triggers economic growth isn't a mystery. And Tito Mboweni seems to know that, but it just shows you how weak the quote-unquote reformist agenda is in cabinet, because this plan of Mboweni is dead on arrival.
Yes, and so it seems like the roadblocks to economic success of patronage politics and ideology continue, unfortunately. But let's move on to something a bit more exciting, which is that our new colleague at the Institute, Ms. Helen Ziller, has recently launched her own podcast called Tea with Helen. If you disagree, come and have tea, which is a good line. For her first interview, she had Peter Bruce. If you search on any of your podcast apps, you should be able to find it quite easily. Herman, what were your impressions from the first episode of the podcast?
I think it was quite good. I really liked it. Mostly because it And I said this on Twitter, and it might be hyperbolical, or sound hyperbolical, but I genuinely believe that this is a kind of a new phase for South African media. This isn't your run-of-the-mill podcast, people who are interested in policy but who don't have real, you know, clout, or who build their clout or presence through this podcast. This is a serious journalist, serious politician, serious stateswoman, coming to the public discussion, public debate, throwing the gauntlet down, not to build an echo chamber, but to kind of break down echo chambers, to invite someone like Peter Bruce, whom she disagrees with, to invite someone like, or disagrees with on some issues, to invite someone like Ferial Hafaji, which I think is the next episode, and I think that's brilliant. It's a serious look at having honest discussion without this traditional media that I think has really made some dangerous decisions in the past week regarding freedom of speech and so on. And I'm very excited to see where this goes and what Helen can achieve with it.
Not much to add there. I think that, you know, She's been a fixture of South African politics for two decades. I mean, reasonably prominent one. And my sense of it is that even amongst those people who dislike her, there is a sense of respect. And I get that impression even by looking at some people in the ANC. She's at least seen as a force to be reckoned with. I think it was quite big of Peter Bruce and Ferial Hafaji to agree to put themselves out there. She's tough. She understands a good story. So, you know, love Helen Zille, hate Helen Zille. This is something to invest an hour of your life in a week. I can highly recommend it.
Yes, and you can also see the filmed version of the interview for the podcast on YouTube if you search for Tea with Helen, and you can subscribe there as well. All right, so I think that about does it for this episode. We will be back on Friday with our filmed version on our YouTube channel, which is Institute of Race Relations. If you like what you heard here, you can support the Institute of Race Relations by SMSing your name to 32823. Join us, become a friend. Your donation of 80 to 100 rand a month can support the work that we do to fight the battle of ideas. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast and some of the other Institute podcasts on iTunes and any of the major podcast apps. We also have the show that I do with Gabriel Krause, Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree. And although Gabriel's away in Russia right now, which has delayed us putting out our next episode. Sihle Ngubesi's show, Liberty and Friends. And thank you for joining us. We'll catch you on the next episode of The Daily Friend.